New Jacksonville. It is Saturday afternoon. It is high noon. It is the Consumer Law Hour with Chuck and Eddie Farah from Farah and Farah. Taking your calls at 855-765-1045. My name is Scott Young. I'm your host here with the Chuck and Eddie in the studio. Waiting for your calls. If you've got questions, they've got answers on your legal concerns. 855-765-1045. What's going on, fellas?
Hey, Scott.
A lot, Scott. It's good to be here, and we appreciate everybody tuning in today. Got some things to talk about. Your phone calls, of course, are a priority, but I do want to get back into one topic that we were looking at a couple of weeks ago, is that whether or not a child can sue their parent for negligence in Florida. Like what happens in a case where a parent's negligent behavior results in injury to his or her own child? I mean, does the child have any legal recourse against a parent? Well, in Florida, the general rule is in Florida that children cannot sue their parents for negligence. That was the rule. The Florida Supreme Court adopted this doctrine of parental immunity in the mid, you know, I think 1982 maybe. But it's been the law basically in Florida that you really can't, a child cannot sue their parent. And the reason why they had that law was enacted was because they did not want to disrupt the family unit. They wanted to create harmony in the family, and they felt if a child could sue their parent for negligence, then, you know, that could be very disruptive and lead to a lot of problems within the family. So anyway, that was the law. But what happened is the law changes, as we know. And, of course, you know, if you're a step-parent, you know, that's not your natural parent. You can't. There's exceptions. You can't, you know, you can sue step-parents. But generally, you can't sue your own parent, your natural parent. The one exception to suing your parents is when it comes to automobile accidents. So if you are negligent and your child is in your vehicle, or you're negligent and your child is injured in some way resulting from an auto accident, your child can sue the parent. But you can only sue the parent up to the amount of the insurance. So if you have a $100,000 policy, the max a child can receive is $100,000. They can't go beyond that and obtain assets from the parents, go after their bank accounts, you know, and other assets.
I feel like there was a story in the news recently about a distraught parent who willfully wrecked a car and had encouraged her kids to assume a unsafe position within the car accordingly. Fortunately, I think the injury situation worked out that everybody involved was okay and got the care necessary. But it seems like that would be the kind of situation where the kids may have some recourse or representation against the mother, in addition to the obvious concerns of, you know, mom being
under the law in Florida. Now, the issue becomes if the child is considered and insured under the policy.
Yeah, that's where the hurdle is.
That's where the hurdle is. Yeah, so typically there is a kind of a there's a problem there, because if the child is considered an insured under the policy, that child won't be able to sue their parent because they're an insured under the policy. It's like suing yourself. Can't sue your,
you know. Okay.
And so there are, I mean, sometimes the policies will prevent somebody from suing their parent, but generally in Florida, if it's an automobile accident, the child can't go after the parent for the insurance money. That's the law in Florida as it is now. I've never handled a case like that. I'm not aware of cases. I'm sure there have been, but
I seem to recall
something. Have you ever handled anything like that?
Not really. I mean, if they've lived in, I have. If they lived, but they lived in separate households, and there was insurance available. But I think you can sue a parent if you're an adult living in your own household and you're driving in your parent's car, and the parent causes an accident. I think you can sue them.
Yeah.
I can't remember collecting over and above the policy limit.
Well, you're limited to the policy limit. So.
And I seem to remember some sort of an incident way back when, maybe it was just an urban myth, about a kid suing parents for the grounds of essentially divorce, which was kind of like an emancipation pursuit or something.
Yeah. That's I don't think you can do that in Florida. That was just probably a publicity thing.
That, or maybe those wacky Californians.
Yeah. That's where everything starts, though, Scott.
Well, it looks like we've got a call on the line already. Yeah. We're jumping into the program today. Riley and Fernandina. Riley, you are on the Consumer Law Hour. How are you today?
Thank you. Good. Hey, Eddie, how are you?
Good, man. Riley, thanks for calling in.
So, I know this is not your specialty, but so we just found out that my wife's identity was stolen to file taxes for the 2018 season, and we're taking care of all that. To your knowledge, how much information will the IRS release to us as to who filed it, where it was mailed, when it was filed, things like that? Would you happen to know anything about that?
I would not know. I know who I can call to find out, maybe, if you want to leave your phone number.
Yeah.
I have a CPA friend that I could reach out to and ask him, because I'm sure he's dealt with it before. So you want to know who this person was that stole your wife's identity and where they live and so forth?
Yeah. So I've had enough experience with investigating stuff to know that there's an end somewhere. I just know that the local police will not take that serious. So what I need to know is how much they're going to release to me, where it was mailed, origin, how it was filed, things like that.
Oh, so you want to make sure that there's a criminal investigation against the person that did it, right?
Yeah, typically, unless you have this information, you can call whoever you want. They're probably not going to conduct a criminal investigation until you have this information in hand.
Well, I know, but how do you know they have that information? I mean, how do you know they even know who the person is? You just know.
Well, we don't.
Yeah.
We don't.
And maybe they don't know.
We have to find out. Somebody filed a tax return somewhere, correct?
Yeah, no, but you really think, I don't know how this works, but depending on the money, I mean, if it's not a lot of money, you think they're going to spend all their resources trying to track this guy down? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I don't know how it works. I mean, usually they're not just doing one tax return. They're doing many tax returns.
Oh, yeah.
It's
I was just curious if how much information the IRS would release on.
Not much. I don't think you're going to get anything out of them because they probably turn it over to the FBI or the Justice Department, and it's theirs after that.
All right. Well, thank you for your time.
Yeah, man. Sorry we couldn't help you.
Have a good day.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Colin Riley. We've got Bobo over in Jax with a nursing home question. You are on the Consumer Law Hour. How are you today?
Good afternoon, guys, and I'm assuming I'm talking to Eddie as well as Chuck, and you guys are certainly welcome to call me Bobo.
No problem, Bobo.
Hey, Bobo.
You're talking to both of them.
What my question is that the last standing, or I guess the last laying parent, was in a nursing home and have since transferred that last parent to another nursing home, but at the previous nursing home, they incurred many bed sores all the way to the degree of a stage 4 and one all the way to the bone where infection has infected the blood and the bones. Is there a lawsuit here? And if so, do you all practice that type of law? And lastly, at what point should you sign a DNR on an 85-year-old person?
Yeah. I'd like to see, who admitted the parent into the nursing home?
The parent signed himself in.
Okay. They signed themselves. Did you have a copy of that document?
I don't at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And at the new place, I guess they're scheduling me to come in next week and sign the parent in over there. So if there's anything I need to be aware of, I'd appreciate that too.
Do you know if there's an arbitration clause in the contract that your mom signed?
Well, it's not mom, it's dad.
I'm sorry.
All right. So I'm not sure. He signed himself in, okay. And I'm not aware of that.
Yeah, because stage 4 the sores should not occur because all that means is they're not turning the patient. I mean, as long as you turn the patient and give them minimal care, you should not have those bed sores. I mean, that's something that should not happen. And typically those are cases that we handle. We have a nurse on staff that can evaluate the records, and we have experts we deal with that we would reach out to and give you an opinion as to whether or not we can handle that for you. But that's generally, bed sores should not happen.
And the bed sore would be on the ear.
Huh?
Would be on the ear, the ankle, the scrotum, I think, and a few other places.
Yeah.
That's just a lack
of care.
I mean, basic. I mean, was that here in Jacksonville?
Yes, here in Jacksonville.
Okay. Yeah, if you want to leave your number with our producer, I can give you a call on Monday or Tuesday about that. We can talk about it further.
Sure. Is there anything I should be cautious of signing when I go to the new place?
Well,
sign him in Monday?
Not really, because I think the injuries have already occurred. I mean, you know what the injuries are. Is that why you took him out, because of that? Of what happened in the previous place?
Right.
Okay. No, I think as long as there are injuries were documented as having occurred at the first place, then you're okay. But read the agreement, see if there's an arbitration clause in that. But we can talk about that Monday. Thanks.
Okay.
All right, Bobo, if you'll stay on the line, Tom will get your information, and we'll be able to follow up with you next week with some additional info. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. The Consumer Law Hour continues on News 104.5 WOKV. And we are back on the Consumer Law Hour on News 104.5 WOKV. Lines are open, taking your calls at 855-765-1045. If you've got legal questions, Chuck and Eddie Farah from the law firm of Farah and Farah here to take those calls. Again, 855-765-1045.
Yes, Scott, before, you heard Shad Khan on the on Bloomberg this week. Chuck was talking, I think Chuck mentioned it, how I think he mentioned that, or Shad said that this is the golden age of manufacturing, that there's this, it's really going like gangbusters. And,
yeah,
the corporations are making money. There ain't no doubt about it. Now, I always wonder whether it's trickling down to anybody else.
Find time to be a rich businessman.
Yes,
or so
I've
heard.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at the corporate, this is not a political show. I'm not trying to get into politics. It's too complicated for me to understand. But the corporate tax rates, have gone from 35% to 21%. Okay, which means they're paying less taxes. Corporations are paying less taxes. In the first quarter of 2018, I'm just giving an example. I mean, I'm just picking out one company. I mean, I don't know what I can't speak for every company, but AbbVie, which is a big pharmaceutical company, paid in the first quarter of 2018, paid 4.5% of the taxes that it paid the year before. So that was like a 96% tax break for that one company. They're the company that manufactures Humira. You've seen it advertised on television. They do 50 million in sales a day. So I'm in that for that one drug, I think. So,
wow.
I mean, you can see the money. And I'll tell you, I mean, you know, anybody who's taken medication knows that the drug prices have not been reduced. So corporations are making more money. They're paying a lot less taxes. Who's getting the benefit of that?
Shareholders.
Rich are getting richer. Yeah. And, I haven't seen the drug prices any lower than what they're going up, really. I mean, as a matter of fact, I was looking at something back since 2017, prices for a group, there was like they looked at 250 medications, different medications. And since 2017's, those prices have increased at least 10%. And nearly 40 of them have increased by more than 100%. So I don't get it. You got corporations making more money, tax breaks, prescription prices are going up. And so I don't know what's going to happen about that. I mean,
the consumer does not make out well on that unless alternatives become available, such as, generics and things like that. And we've talked about that repeatedly in the past about how certain companies will, forego the distribution of
the
generics by way of influence from the big money.
Yeah, they pay for delay. They pay the generic company not to put it out in the market. So anyway,
we've got another caller on the line.
Maybe somebody knows the answer to these questions. Go ahead.
We've got Elaine in Orange Park with a question about arbitration versus trial.
Yes.
Elaine, you're on the Consumer Law Hour. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Elaine.
Hello. Yes, I just recently went to a doctor's visit, my annual screening, and when I arrived there, I found out that my doctor had been brought out by another company, and I filled out all the paperwork, and they gave me paperwork to sign away my right to a jury trial and just go to arbitration should something ever go wrong, and I just wanted to know, was that a good idea?
Well, it depends. You know, you're giving up your right to go in front of a jury, okay? But I mean, it depends on the situation, but typically it may not, in that situation, it may not be good on your behalf. And they, I mean, but the thing about it is, if you don't sign it, they don't have to take you as a patient.
Right. That's okay, what they told
just,
me.
Yeah, you can just go find somebody else. I mean, if you're not happy signing that, I mean, the arbitration, what happens is typically, and I have to read the agreement, that you pick an arbitrator, they pick an arbitrator, then those two arbitrators pick a third arbitrator. And you go in front of an arbitration and you present your case, and then they, you know, they make a decision. A lot of people don't like that. They rather take their case in front of a jury. So they think they have a better chance in front of a jury. I mean, the juries are much more expensive, and I mean, jury trials are a lot more work. I mean, it's give and take on both sides.
Okay.
But yeah, but either accept the terms or you find another physician.
Okay. Nice. All right. Yeah, I just have never been to a doctor's office who said I had to give up a certain right in order for me to be
known. No, there's some. A lot of doctors are doing that now. And the previous caller that was in the talked about the nursing home situation. Almost every nursing home contract I've seen has a provision in there that requires you to go to arbitration if there's an issue.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Good luck.
Elaine, appreciate your call. Have a good afternoon. Tom in Orange Park has got a question for us. Something to do with his son and a company shutting down and no pay being available for his son. Tom,
hey, Tom.
How are you today?
Just fine. Thank you, guys. My son was working for a company here in town, and they shut down with basically no notice. And they haven't contacted him about paying him for the hours that he worked at all. I'm just trying to give him some advice.
Well, are they going to pay him?
Oh, I don't know. You can't even figure out how to get a hold of him. If he calls their number, no, there's no one there to answer.
I mean, under Florida law, he could sue that. Is it a couple of weeks worth of, is it 2 weeks of pay or a week or?
It's a couple of days last week and a couple of days this week.
Okay, because under Florida law, if an employer does not pay you the wages they owe you, you can sue them in small claims court and get treble damages, which means you're able to obtain three times what they owe you.
Right.
And you can require them to pay your attorney at the same time, which will happen. But, I mean, you got to make sure they have the money to pay you. I mean, they went out of business,
exactly.
And that's the problem. I mean, you can sue them and get a verdict, but
right.
They don't have
if
the
there's
cash.
There's no money. There's no money.
You got to chase them. Then you got to try to chase them around to collect it. That costs more money. So, hello, is it a corporation or is it individually owned?
No. I believe it was a corporation.
Yeah, well,
but it's a smaller corporation.
And what assets does the corporation have if they shut down? I mean, they may have some
offices. Judging by what type of business it was, they should have quite a bit of assets. So I just didn't know what to tell him or any advice I could give him. Or if he needed to speak to an attorney. You know, it's not a whole lot of money.
Well, I mean, it's probably not an attorney. I mean, why would he not be able to handle that on himself? He can go to small claims court. They'll fill out the paperwork for you.
Right.
I mean, it's a clear-cut case. He owes them. They owe him for X amount of dollars, and I mean, if you look at the wage, it's called wage theft. There's a Florida statute that governs it that gives you everything that you need, all the ammunition you need, damages, makes them pay your attorney's fees, makes you pay the court costs and filing fees. I don't think you need a lawyer to do it.
Okay, well, I'll see if I can figure out how to help you.
You're going to find the name of the corp. Go to SunBiz, the SunBiz website, and they'll give you the name of the corporation and who to serve.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, Tom, thanks for calling. Stick around. More of the Consumer Law Hour coming up after a quick break. Check of Fox News, local traffic and weather, and the Consumer Law Hour will continue on News 104.5 WOKV. In Jacksonville, we are back on the Consumer Law Hour. Lines are open for you, 855-765-1045 if you've got questions. Law firm of Fair and Fair, our sponsor, Chuck and Eddie Farrah in the studio. Again, 855-765-1045. If you've got questions, Consumer Law Hour is here to help.
Yeah. Scott, you don't really hear about these cases too often, but what happens when somebody files a false report of criminal behavior to law enforcement? I mean, somebody goes to the police and tries to say, you know, files a false report, try and someone gets arrested or someone is injured as a result of that, what kind of recourse do you have against the person that filed the false report? I've never handled a case like that, although there have been cases reported and, I mean, you read about them sometimes, but I've never been involved in that. But the law is pretty strict, or it's pretty cut and dry when it comes to that. And what you've got to prove is somebody goes to the police and you end up being arrested for it, or, you know, I know there's a case I'll talk about in a second where somebody was actually injured as a result of it. You've got to prove basically that the person that filed the report acted recklessly and almost knew it was a lie before and still reported the incident. So here's a case where a bank was robbed. The police show up. You know, they call in, you know, there's a silent alarm. The police show up at the bank, and there's a customer on the floor, and the customer kind of looks like the bank robber. So they got this customer on the floor. They handcuff him, and one of the police officers kicks the customer in the head. But this customer, of course, is not the bank robber.
Right.
He's dressed like the bank robber. And so, of course, the customer is injured, and the customer sues the bank for, you know, this false report of a criminal behavior. He goes, I wasn't a bank robber. I'm a customer. I get whacked in the head. I've got this severe injury. You would think that'd be a clear-cut case where he could sue the bank. But the court said no, because, it was a mistake. That the person who called in the silent alarm to the bank forgot to tell the police that that was not the bank robber. So even in that situation, which I would think that would be a case that would go forward, because why didn't he tell the police when they got there, this is not the guy? He never told the police that this was not the bank robber. And
the court, the kind of thing you would be able to determine too, as you're standing there watching a guy about to get kicked in the head.
Yeah, but you know, probably there's a lot going on in those kind of situations. You're not just sitting back. I mean, maybe there's things going on, or there's a protocol they're following. But I really thought this case would go forward, but the court threw it out, saying that it was a mistake, that it was not intentional. It was not. It wasn't like the bank teller or the bank said, that guy on the floor is the bank robber.
Knowing he's not.
It's not. He didn't say anything.
Was the gentleman able to pursue any kind of claim against the officers for assault or anything like that, too?
Well, no, because the officers were acting within, you know, thinking that. I mean, they had a description of the bank robber. This guy looked like the bank robber. Let's go get him. I mean, that's not going to be a case. And the person at the bank never told the police that was not the person. But regardless of all that, so basically if you're going to sue someone for falsely reporting that you were involved in a criminal situation, it's almost got to be an intentional type or malicious, reckless.
You got to be able to prove some kind of malfeasance.
Exactly. All right. But thanks.
I like that word.
Phone calls. Yeah. It's a good word to use.
Edward in Jacksonville is on the line for us. He's got a question regarding an auto accident. Edward, you're on with Consumer Law Hour with Farrah and Farrah.
Yes. Hello. I appreciate you guys the service you guys do. Quick question to make this quick. Father was involved in a car accident. The other driver was cited at fault. Father has general liability required by the state of Florida, so his insurance doesn't cover anything. The other driver had no insurance. My dad ended up filing a civil court suit for a small amount to replace his vehicle. The other driver filed a bankruptcy. Then we're kind of stuck at that point.
The person that caused the accident did not have any coverage. He had no insurance.
No insurance.
Okay. Well, you know, under the law in the state of Florida, they're going to suspend his license.
I guess they have suspended the license of the other person. The person was driving, though, was
right.
It was not her vehicle. It was her mom's vehicle. She had no insurance in the vehicle.
So the owner
was driving.
Yeah, the owner of the car had no insurance.
Correct.
And the driver, correct, the daughter, did not own her own car where she had her insurance, right?
Correct.
Okay, and so who filed bankruptcy, the mother or the daughter?
Mother.
Filed bankruptcy. Okay, I don't know how that affects the state, but I know the state steps in when you cause an accident and you don't have the required coverage. They make you purchase a more expensive insurance policy, and they suspend your license until you do that.
So, but as far as as far as any cost of damages or replacing his vehicle, is kind of stuck pretty much without a vehicle.
Right.
And there's, I just want to know any, in your opinion, any suggestion how to move forward of getting some type of reimbursement from the other person for the damages?
I don't know, because of the bankruptcy, I don't know if you can do that.
That debt.
But I just don't know if this, you can discharge your requirement under the statute, Chuck, because when you don't have the insurance coverage you're required to have, the state steps in. And again, suspend your license until you obtain a policy. And they can make you pay damages. Have you been down to DMV and asked them about it?
They are not able to give any advice how to proceed with that.
Why don't you leave your phone number? I'll reach out to someone who may know about that, and I can call you on Monday.
Sounds great.
Because I know the bankruptcy generally discharges all your debts. Generally, there are some debts that are not dischargeable. I just want to know if that's one of the exceptions of not being.
It may come under the traffic laws where you have to
The bankruptcy may not be any good. Because, so anyway, Edward, why don't you leave your contact information, and I'll be in phone contact with you next week.
I will do that. Thanks. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for calling, Edward. We've got James on the south side who has a question regarding a writ of garnishment. James, you're on the Consumer Law Hour.
Yes.
Yes, gentlemen. Good afternoon. James. In particular to Eddie Fair, he was kind enough to call me back a couple of times early last year. I've been struggling with this nonsense for quite some time. It's come to where one of the credit card companies that I had to walk away from making payments because I'd come down to my last dollar. They followed through. I got the summons, all the other paperwork, and now through a local law firm that's a collection firm, they've filed a writ of garnishment against me. In the paperwork, there's a waiver that I'm allowed to file. I can read it, and it's somewhat simple. My only idiotic question is, it's glaringly obvious to me and to my bank. I only have one checking account, no savings, no income, wages, anything else, nothing. The only source of income, if not income, is the monthly Social Security supplemental check that comes to the checking account. Is there a way for the bank to convey that to not only the court and or this collection law firm, or I truly do have to go through getting this notarized, handing it in, sending copies to A and B and all that.
We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I don't do that type of work, but there's a document that prevents. Are you a head of household?
I'm the only person this concerns. Yes, just me.
Well, I don't know if you can claim head of household. Is anybody dependent upon you for support?
No, just myself.
I know that, but I don't think you can. That will. I don't think that's going to give you the protection you're looking for.
You can't claim yourself for
head of household. You got to have somebody who's dependent upon you for support, like a spouse, a child, a parent, somebody.
But that is one of the options on the waiver form. The other option, or a list of them, is SSI.
Yes, so okay.
My only
source
of support is the SSI. I check the box. I sign it.
Right.
It's notarized.
Right.
I turn it in. I mail two copies to party A and B, and that's it. But again, my stupid, ill-informed question was, why can't the court or the supposed attempted garnishee make contact with the bank and verify that, hey, this poor insipid fellow only gets one SSI payment per month. That's his only source of survival. And that satisfies the question. No need for this other stuff to go on.
Well, maybe it won't go on once they have you heard back from the attorney? Because once they receive the affidavit from you that it's notarized and it's been, you filed it with the court, right?
Well, no, the paperwork came the other day. I'm attempting to take care of it now. I'll get it notarized, yeah, turned into the court, and then go from there.
Right.
But I'm sorry. I know it's a stupid question, but since they're so involved and aware of what someone does or doesn't do, why can't they communicate with my bank and say, hey, James only gets the bank could tell them what the daily average balance is for the last year. It's nothing after that.
I know that, but I think once you file the affidavit with the court and you send a copy to the attorney who's trying to garnish the account, then they will dismiss that writ of garnishment. You may not even have to have a hearing on it. I mean, I don't think.
I think I understand that. And that was the other part that was somewhat upsetting or mind-boggling, that there actually would need to be a hearing on it. And what am I supposed to do? Walk in with a copy of each monthly bank statement showing that the SSI deposit is the only
you could do that, or you could testify under oath. The judge will put you under oath. Unless they have any evidence to the contrary, you're going to win that hearing. But I don't even think it'll go to a hearing. I think once they receive the affidavit and the judge gets it, they may just dismiss it.
Yes, sir. I understand that. I appreciate your time and help. Thank you.
All right.
All right. Thanks for calling, James. We appreciate the call. We will be back with the final segment of the Consumer Law Hour coming up in just a few moments. Joseph, Ron, I see you on the lines. Stick around. We will be right back with you on News 104.5 WOKV. We are back for the final segment of the Consumer Law Hour on News 104.5 WOKV. Right to the phones. I see we have a caller, Joseph from Jacksonville, with a question about reopening his parents' estate. Joseph, you're on with Farrah and Farrah.
Hey, Joseph.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I greatly appreciate it. I was recently asked to reopen my parents' estate, and when I asked the attorney the reason why that I'm going to have to provide for reopening the estate, I was told not to tell anyone. And that sent a huge red flag up to me.
Did he give you a reason why he wanted to? Did he give you a reason why he wanted to open it up? I mean, was there some unfinished business that you're aware of that was not taken care of,
like assets in this state that weren't distributed, or
basically that wasn't paid? Basically, it's a lawsuit. From the families of the survivors of the Beirut bombing.
All right, so.
And they haven't gone to court. They haven't been certified by the State Department. And they haven't taken depositions. And I'm just.
Well, that makes sense because
has the statute of limitations not run on that?
They're saying.
Well, who's bringing the claim for the Beirut bombing? Who's bringing the claim?
A Washington law group.
But who's the plaintiff? Who's like the person suing or who was injured in the bombing?
Well, my father was.
Okay, so.
And he passed away. So it's the survivors of the Beirut bombing.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah. Okay. And you're suing. Because you have to have a representative to maintain the suit. Okay.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah, you guys make sense. So what he wants to do is he wants to reopen the estate and probably have you appointed as the personal representative so you can bring the lawsuit. Because right now there's nobody designated to bring that case.
Yeah. I mean, you can file a lawsuit without an estate, but then eventually you gotta
have a PR.
You gotta have a PR.
Because, you've got to have somebody that who's a spokesperson or kind of leads the case. So he's probably giving you good advice. Why are you concerned about that?
It seems too soon. That's why, they haven't been certified by the State Department, which takes 3 to 12 months. And best case scenario, they don't have a court case.
Yeah, but they still need it.
They probably want to get a court case going.
Yeah.
And if you're not if there's no estate open, they may just figure, well, there's nobody that wants to pursue this claim on your behalf for your family. I mean, I don't see any downside of you reopening the estate. The only thing is, How long ago did your father pass away?
2013.
All right. I'm just wondering if there's any debts. I mean, were there any debts owed by the estate?
No, I opened the estate, settled any debts. They were advertised.
Right.
The estate was closed.
Right. Okay. So there's nobody, was there anybody trying to sue your father for anything?
I mean, had they filed a lawsuit in his own name while he was alive?
When they initially contacted him for this, he did not want any part of it because he, my mother, me, and my sister considered it blood money at the time. We still do. Me and my sister still consider it blood money. The only reason why I'm participate this far is that my sister is medically disabled. That money would be a boon to her and her husband.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Based on the general facts that you've given me, there should not be a problem of opening that estate. And the State Department is probably requiring an estate to be open if you want to participate in that lawsuit because they got to know who to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're the like the executor or the personal representative, they know who is.
Right.
I mean, they know that you're involved and that you're going to be dealing with it. Right now, who are they contacting? I mean, you got brothers and sisters, and I mean, nobody knows.
Just one sister. Yeah,
still, but they don't know that. They got to have a family representative that they know is interested in pursuing this lawsuit.
I am the family representative to the attorney.
Right. Well, then that's probably something you need to do. I mean, if you want to pursue that claim, eventually you're going to have to be appointed the personal representative.
Right. I'm just worried. I just think
what are you worried about? What is your concern? Huh?
I guess my concern is, am I opening up a can of worms?
Yeah. I don't. Based on what you've told me, I don't think you've exposed yourself to anything. You're suing a foreign government, correct?
No, what you want to do is get the contract between you and the lawyer, read that over. Make sure you're not responsible for costs and all that. But
supposedly they're getting 36% of any funds reclaimed.
Well, and is it going to be okay. So they're working on a contingency. You're not required to put up any money, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, you're going to look at the contract. That's where you got to start. I mean, if you want to leave your number, I can call you and talk to you more about it. If you want to send me the contract, I can look at it and tell you if it's truly a contingency fee contract.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Joseph, we appreciate the call. Thanks to all of our callers today. We appreciate the opportunity to provide any guidance that we can offer. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week on the Consumer Law Hour.